What up, peeps? Welcome into Unscripted and Unprepared, brought to you by Real Screen Magazine. I'm Jimmy Fox, and this episode is my sit-down with Rob LaPlante and Jeff Spangler, presidents and co-owners of Lighthearted Entertainment. We recorded this months ago at Real Screen in New Orleans before the world turned upside down. And, you know, I thought to myself, we're all quarantined. We're all trapped in our homes. Our professional and personal lives have been thrown in a tailspin. You know what we could use right now? A little lightheartedness. So I'm gonna pop in this interview for you guys. We've been sitting on it for a few months now. This was one of my favorite episodes we've ever recorded because I had never met Rob and Jeff before. I looked forward to talking to them about Are You the One? The guys were super open and honest about their relationship and the memory of Howard Schultz and what he meant in their lives as a mentor, having left them the company. And also, Rob had some great stuff to spill about his time working on The Apprentice and his exchanges and experiences with Donald Trump. That's all coming up. But first, a little special treat for you guys. I don't know about all of you. I've been down as of late. I've had anxiety. I've had cabin fever, being trapped in the home for the last 5 weeks. If you could see me right now, you would see my beard that I've grown out. Tells the whole story. So I wanted to do something special because this week, something happened, something that lifted my spirits, that took my mind completely off of COVID. And because this is an unscripted nonfiction podcast, I have an excuse to talk about it. I'm talking about The Last Dance. I'm talking about the 10-part series on ESPN and eventually on Netflix about the 97-98 Bulls and Michael Jordan. A documentary that had been sitting in a warehouse somewhere in New Jersey for damn near 16 years until the NBA and Michael Jordan were on the same page and ready to do something with it. And I thought to myself, there's one person in this world, more than anybody, that I would want to talk to about this documentary. And you guys don't know who he is. He's a stranger to you, but he's no stranger to me because he's been my best friend since freshman year in high school. And he was the first Michael Jordan friend I ever had, the first aficionado of Jordan sneakers that I ever had in my life. So I am proud to introduce to all of you my high school friend and one of the best men at my wedding, Nick Berger. Welcome to Unscripted and Unprepared.
Wow, Jim. I mean, I feel humbled. That was so nice of you. Thank you. I've never heard you say those nice things about me before. I feel good.
Do you want to tell the audience the real reason why you're on this podcast right now, how this came to be?
Yeah, because you know that I am so knowledgeable about the subject matter that you feel like there's no one else in the world that could provide you the true inside scoop about what makes this so great. So you called me and I said, of course I'll do it.
Well, I think the real exchange was I texted you and I was like, Berger, I'm going to need your full breakdown of this documentary. And you were like, well, Jim, unless you put me on the podcast to talk about it, I'm not going to give you any of my feelings. So you kind of forced me into a corner.
I did. I've been trying to force you into this corner for a long time, and I never thought it would come to fruition, and it has. You know,
this is literally the one time that you would actually make sense to have on the podcast. So here we are. So
I know.
Let's get into the quick takeaways. So the episode, I don't know when this podcast is going to come out, but we watched this last night. The first 2 hours premiered. I'm thinking maybe if this goes well and people don't totally, you know, revolt against my podcast by having you on, maybe we have you come back on after the finale airs. But let's just jump right into key takeaways from night one of The Last Dance. Go through some of your key takeaways that popped on your list.
I think for me, like the first thing that I thought about is like it was great seeing Jordan from college. And I think that I was surprised even myself to see how much he put into what Dean Smith and Phil Jackson had taught him about basketball and about life. So I thought that was one of the big takeaways that, you know, with all of this greatness, he still listened to his coaches and what they had to say. And that still shaped him. And he always listened. And he wasn't a difficult person to coach, even being the greatest of all time. Right? Like he, there's no problems with him. I mean, he always focused with his coaches.
By the way, that was amazing. Same takeaway my wife had, same takeaway Missy had. She was like, wait, so Michael
Jordan. She's a wonderful woman.
Suburb of Chicago. She couldn't wait for this. She made the same observation. She's like, wait, so Michael Jordan had like really good relationships with both his like major coaches. And I was like, yeah. And she's like, yeah, you look at LeBron, and LeBron is like a coach killer. And some other, you know, great players we've seen have been coach killers. So yeah, that was an astute observation. What else did you take away?
Well, that was my numero uno. I think the number two is that, you know, he being who he is, you know, he said, you have to earn it. Right. And you saw right away that, you know, he was athletically gifted more than anybody, but at the same time, he worked so hard and he said, I have to earn this. And he never, even when he went into Chicago, hearing somebody say like that, you know, it's been so highly touted and turned into the greatest ever. And to say that, hey, I walked on the floor and I figured out who was the leader of that team. And I went after him because I knew I had to earn this. And I was starting on the bottom rung of the ladder, having come off a national championship in college and being one of the greatest players in college basketball history. People were already talking about him, and he still knew that he had to make that point and prove to himself and to the team. So I think the fact that he has to earn it, right? Like, I just feel like in today's game, and you hear the stars talk, you know, and you know, I'm not as big as a basketball fan as I once was, but I think that's part of the turnoff, right? Like, can't identify with that, right? You were a hardworking athlete. If people on this show don't know that, you know, and you worked very hard. And I think that anyone who played sports knew how hard you had to work. And it shows that the greatest ever had to work. So yeah, you got to earn it.
No, you're right. I mean, the rookies now that come in, it seems like they're kind of entitled when they come in from day one. And Michael's approach was, I'm going to find the alpha on this team. It's like the prison yard mentality. I'm going to find the alpha on this team, and I'm going to go for his job from day one. And I think in the doc, they said it was something like the third game of the season, he pretty much established himself as the best player on that team immediately. What else you got?
Number three that I thought was incredible, and they did this very well in the documentary, is that they had a former resident of Chicago as well as a former governor of the state of Arkansas talk in episode one and episode two. And number one for Jordan, like you can see, and you, I mean, even seeing what he would, I think, didn't Obama award him that medal was that yeah, he can do to civilians, you know, but you can truly see in his, when hearing Obama talk, who's widely admired, just hearing him talk about Michael Jordan and what he did for the city of Chicago and what he did for the United States, I think is pretty incredible, right? And I think it was funny how they introduced him like that, but I think that was pretty amazing. And then hearing
everybody on Twitter was talking about how they introduced Obama as former Chicago native.
Yeah. And that's hilarious. Like, yeah, you know, and you hear about our current president, right? And you read all the stuff in the tabloids about like when he was in movies and whatnot, and in your profession, the stuff that he would demand, and the ex-president sitting there and he's saying a former Chicago resident. So clearly, you know, like he might be a real guy. You know?
I also love that they found good. I love that they found an excuse to have Bill Clinton in the documentary just because he once saw Scottie Pippen play in Central Arkansas. And that was the whole reason to call Bill Clinton, fly to wherever Bill Clinton is, sit him down, and probably do like an hours long interview with him, literally just so he could say, I saw Scottie Pippen play at Central Arkansas.
I agree.
What else you got?
What was that? Is that three?
I think that was three.
The other thing that I thought was amazing was that I think, you know, anybody, again, growing up or playing any type of the sport and trying to be good at them, right? Like, distraction always takes you everywhere, right? I mean, it always takes you in different directions and makes you focus on different things. And obviously nobody grew up with him or saw, but it didn't seem like distraction played a role, right? I mean, in high school, girls come into the picture, you're focusing on girls or chasing the opposite sex or partying or doing whatever. It seemed like he had one focus and he had laser focus on one thing, and that was being the best at playing basketball that he could be. And, you know, he never wavered from that. And I've read about a lot of people have pulled that out as well. And I think that's absolutely true. You know, like everyone gets caught up in things that, you know, at the time you think are super important, but in all actuality, they're not, right? So I think that was
Yeah, and also like his rookie year, like he comes in and they're talking about how the Bulls were like, what was it, like the cocaine train or something, like a runaway cocaine train or something like that.
Yeah.
And comes in and he basically goes, all right, if that's how these guys roll, I'm on my own. And he said, from that point on, I knew I was on my own. And he just chilled at his apartment. He didn't go out. He didn't smoke. He didn't do drugs. He didn't drink yet, he said. He just liked to like play cards coming out of college. Like he was a chill kid. And all he wanted to do, he was all about ball. And he was all about from day one being the best. And you're right. Like, there were no distractions with the guy. The guy was laser focused on what his goal was from day one. And he actually, and I believed it, like he meant it when he said it, that he wanted to make the Bulls relevant. And they were absolutely not relevant, even in their own city, until he showed up, which I did not know. I did not know that prior to Michael Jordan, there was no history with the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, it was like the, well, what did they say? The professional indoor, soccer team at the time was a bigger draw, right?
The indoor soccer team was a bigger
draw. I had no idea about that, or the cocaine or any of that. I had no idea.
Yeah.
So that was great. So okay. That was that.
Is that are those your takeaways? Because I can jump into mine.
Let me see. Well, I think the last one, it was kind of funny hearing all the people talk about how he was never going to be the greatest of all time and he was hyped. Enjoyed seeing that stuff too, right? Like people saying like, oh, yeah, you know, he's not going to be the greatest. I thought the funny thing too was seeing transformationally how far the game has changed is that when you saw those big men come on and say, you know, he's only 6'6", so he's never going to be, never going to be able to drive the NBA, and how everyone was so focused on like, center is what's going to be exciting or what's going to drive basketball. It's like, that didn't make any sense. I'm sure it did at the time, but I was like, clearly a lot of people were misdirected.
Yeah, no, because when you just started saying that, I was like, yeah, how does that make any sense? Because he was already walking into the era of Magic and Bird. But then again, Magic had Kareem and Bird had Walton and Parrish. So you were like, I guess a team was only as good as its big man in that era. Because three, by the way, did you also notice all those highlights where there was no 3-point line?
That's true. That's true.
And it was interesting. Like that felt like ancient history watching that with no 3-point line. But the other day, someone brought to my attention that kids in college now, like 20-year-olds, Berger, they weren't even around for the Lakers, the Shaq Kobe Lakers three-peat. So there's like a whole generation
between it now, right?
Watching Michael Jordan highlights to them is like us watching like Bill Russell highlights. You know what I mean? Like it's so far before their time. It's amazing that there really is this whole other generation that have only been raised on LeBron and just missed Kobe by 5 minutes that really have no perception of what Jordan really meant. I mean, this is like us watching a Babe Ruth doc now. Like we've heard about how great Babe Ruth is our whole life, but we didn't really ever feel it in any real way. It's just like something our grandparents told us. That's what Jordan is for like this Gen Z audience. Anyway, let me run through my takeaways real quick. Jerry Krause, the GM, had no idea how single-handedly he pretty much created all the dysfunction within that organization. And he was the sole reason, it seemed, that Jackson and Pippen and Jordan couldn't just be happy. And that's even after winning 5 championships. That blew me away. And part of me was like torn because he's not alive to defend himself. He's been dead for 3 years. So it feels sometimes like they're just piling on a guy that isn't around to speak his side. But then again, he invited, after 5 championships, he invited the whole team to his wedding and the coach he wanted to replace Phil Jackson with and not Phil Jackson, after having won 5 championships as his coach. So he kind of made his bed. So the Jerry Krause of it all, just completely effing this whole thing up, was astounding to me. Also,
I couldn't believe with that though, that Reinsdorf's a billionaire. Like one, how does a baseball scout end up the GM of an NBA basketball team? I love to understand
how
that.
About, and two, how about this?
How does he let that happen? How does Reinsdorf let that happen?
How about, yes, to that point, how does the owner, Reinsdorf, if Jordan and Phil Jackson and Scottie Pippen are upset, hey, you know what? It's easier to find another general manager than it is to find 3 individuals to replace them. Right? You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand why you're choosing the GM.
No, it does not make any sense.
Over the happiness of Michael Jordan and Phil Jackson after they've earned you 5 championships. Again, that doesn't make any sense. So that was astounding to me how one man's ego could ruin the greatest, like literally the greatest run we had ever seen in modern sports. I won't go through everything because we're already running a little bit long, but you know what held up really well? And speaking of the things that the kids aren't hip to these days, LL Cool J, the LL Cool J sequence during that Boston OT. Like, I was watching this. I'm like, oh my God, this younger generation just know LL Cool J as the guy in like NCIS New Orleans. And they don't know him as the one man Run DMC.
Probably not even that. They know him from Lip Sync Battle, Jimmy.
Oh, good call. Good call.
No, they probably know him from that. They don't even know him from NCIS.
Thank you for bringing it back to what this podcast is really supposed to be based on, unscripted TV. Thank you for reminding me of that. So that, like, that held up really well. That whole Boston sequence of that OT, was it 63 points or 61 points?
Three.
63, yeah. Right? That whole sequence was amazing. Also, the honesty of everyone at the time when they were speaking to the press, there was no like fluff. There was no playing coy. Everyone told the press exactly how they felt in the moment. Like Michael commenting on the future of the team, Scotty commenting on the future of the team, Phil commenting on what's going on, the dysfunction, who's coming back, who's not, not liking what ownership's doing, not liking what the GM's doing. It was so unlike today, where LeBron and Kevin Durant, all these people are so passive aggressive in how they deal with the media, how they subtweet people on social media, or, you know, throw these like jabs, you know, at like a GM or owner, but kind of like shade it and veil it a little bit. Everyone in this doc at the time, they were just saying how they felt. So like the transparency of how people communicated back then was really refreshing.
Absolutely.
And then the last thing was just how they edited it together. Like, you're watching that first episode and you're like, I'm just thinking, like, if you're bestowed this project, like as a filmmaker, and it's like, all right, we got to make 10 hours and we have all of this story. The way they constructed that first hour to set the tone that we are just jump-starting right into 97, 98. They just won their fifth ring. It's total dysfunction. Nobody has any idea who's coming back for this next season. And then they go to Paris, and now we're in Paris on this, like, on this tour, this exhibition tour. Then all of a sudden we jump in the timeline backwards, and now we're at North Carolina and we're going into like Jordan's origin story. And then we cut back and now we're back into Paris again. Like, they set the tone that in every hour, there's going to be two timelines that we follow. There's going to be the 97-98 A story timeline, but then we're going to jump out of that at any one point, and then we're going to go back in time and tell the story of one of the players involved.
Character development.
Right. And that's what they did in hour two with Scottie Pippen. And it's beautiful. I mean, it's so masterful how they're going to get all the backstory of all these players and still tell this linear 97-98 story throughout the 10 hours. That blew me away as well. That was one of my key takeaways. Perfect. Anything else you want to add for the peeps? I think one thing would be just to get your feelings. All, like, you are the first guy I ever met that ever bought two Jordan shoes at a time.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell the audience why you bought two Jordans from the time you were like a little boy?
Yeah. I mean, I think one to save and one to wear, you know?
So you would wear one and you would save the other, so it was mint condition in the box.
Yes, I would. And I put them away. And then it's one of my only things that I can't stand about Jordan is the constant re-release of all the stinkers and the flooding of the market and ruining the value of what I saved so hard for as a young boy. So all of my shoes are on consignment now in the Bay Area up here, right? So problem is I'm a size 12. So that's a big size. So they sit for a long time. I learned a lot about sneakerheads now, but basically there's people out there that want the first ones of a re-release. Like, it doesn't matter to them that the same exact shoe got re-released 10 days ago. There's this group of a smaller subset, obviously, that want the original re-releases or the original from back when in dead stock condition. Mm. But also I can't wear any of my shoes because something that, you know, you never thought of back then is that if you don't wear them, the glue breaks down in the shoes. Oh. So the sole can just pop off or the air pockets pop.
That happened to me. That happened to my Jordan 5s like a few years ago. They just sat in the closet and they just like literally like dissolve.
Pop. And they get foggy. People still even want them with foggy air pockets as long as they're dead stock. But the stores, you know, you pay $400 for a pair of sneakers and you might wear them once and the sole pops off. So people are like, I don't want to buy that. So it takes a really select person now to buy the original most of mine are original re-releases. So the first time they did it.
Okay, just real quick before we go, tell the audience your favorite Jordan sneakers of all time aesthetically, not to wear, but just the design.
I don't want to be cliche and say the 11 patent leathers, but I mean, the 11 Space Jams are the best. But
we'll take the 11s out. You can't say the 11s because that's a popular choice.
Yeah, I love the 14s because they're designed on a 550 Maranello Ferrari. And you, as you know, Jimmy, I love cars. And Tinker Hatfield made that connection. And I've always loved those sneakers in the original colorways, which was black, white, and red.
You know, I think in my other life, I would have been a great general manager for a sports franchise because the greatest trade I ever pulled off, and I don't know if you remember this, was in high school with Mikey Powell, and I traded him a used Wu-Tang 36 Chamber CD for his Jordan 11s that were like two sizes too big for him and like one size too big for me. And I traded the CD for the Jordan 11s. Do you remember that by any chance?
I do, because they were my Jordan 11s from eighth grade that I sold, that I gave to Mikey that you got. So yes, I do remember that. They're dope shoes, man.
You should Google right now. I never buy myself anything, but when I was out in Chicago for All-Star Weekend this year, because we were doing a project there, I was like, you know what? It's been a stressful few months. This project has been like, you know, really hard to put together. I'm buying myself some new shoes. I'm going to treat myself. I never buy myself anything. And I saw the shoes that Russell Westbrook wore at the All-Star game, which are Jordan brand shoes. And I'm not even a Russell Westbrook guy. These shoes, Nick, are like the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life. They're not like just shoes. They are art. And I went out and I got them. They're like multicolor. I can't even describe them. They're like every color of the rainbow, just flames. And you got to see these. You just Google Russell Westbrook 2020 All-Star Game. And I finally got them. And I got to tell you, I get more compliments on those. And I have Jordan 3s now, the black and cement ones, the Jordan 3s. And I get so many compliments on them when I wear them to work for like pitch meetings. People think I'm way more creative than I really am if I just wear some flashy shoes in a meeting. Are you pulling them
those
up?
Those are pretty dope.
Right?
I like those. Yeah, they are.
Yeah.
They are. See, I can't go down this path anymore, though. I don't need that addiction. I don't need it.
Oh, is that what it is for you? Like you're out, and it's like you're kind of.
I know if I get it back in and I do one, I'll buy another one, and I'll buy more, and I'll buy more. You know, and now we're older, and $200 isn't what it was when we were freshmen in college. So it's right. Like, well, oh yeah, I can do this. And pretty soon it consumes my life, and I'm staying up till midnight hitting F5 and refresh on Nike.com. I don't need that path. So,
all right, Nick.
I like these sneakers.
Nick Berger, thanks for coming on the podcast. And I'll tell you what, if people respond and say this was good enough for them, I'll have you back on after the finale runs in 4 weeks for Last Dance. Okay.
Yeah. Now I got to think about something else to pressure you on. So thank you for having me on. So.
Talk to you later, man.
All right, man.
All right, lighthearted interview coming up next. All right, so I'm here in a conference room at the beautiful Sheraton here at Real Screen East, and I can already tell this is going to be a fun one. I've never met you guys before. We've already been kind of like shooting the S, you know, talking football and whatnot before we start rolling. Rob, Jeff, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
This is going to be good.
Yeah.
I mean, we were out quite late last night, so I apologize in advance. But
you're getting the full Real Screen experience.
Exactly, Real Screen. It's not about what happens at the Sheraton. Or at least hopefully good stories happen outside of the Sheraton that you bring back to the Sheraton.
You were saying there might have been a casino involved?
Yes.
That does happen here in New Orleans.
Yes.
And
we get to watch some of the more successful producers in our industry just burning money like it doesn't matter.
Did you guys play? Did you guys come out on top?
No. Let's be honest. There is no winners when you leave a casino late in the evening.
Yeah. You leave it the hour that we left. Nobody leaves with money. Everyone is light in every way.
Yes.
So I want to train the audience to know whose voice is who. So Jeff.
Yes. Hello.
I want to start with you because I don't know you guys from Adam. I want to know your whole backstory.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do this because obviously everybody I think knows Lighthearted.
know your hits. They know, are you the one? But there's probably a lot of new executives in the business, a lot of new, you know, network folks and producers coming up that don't know, you know, Howard Schultz, that don't know how the company was founded and don't know your guys' personal story.
Yeah.
But before we even get there, and there's a lot I want to cover, but I just want to get to know you guys. So I'll start with Jeff. Like, I want to hear your first jobs. Like, what broke you? Like, how you came up? Like, what was the first TV job for you?
First TV job was, I was a casting recruiter. And basically, so to take one step back, I went to Arizona State University. I was, and it's everything that you think it is, right?
I almost went
there. Yeah, and so it's ridiculous. I was a club promoter. I was like in the mix in Scottsdale. And so ultimately what I was, when I was there and I was looking for, you know, like just kind of in that scene, I knew what I was good at, which I was ultimately was talking to people, coming up to them, making sure that they're having a great time. Right. But
when you're doing a promotion job, you're pretty much producing without knowing you're producing.
Oh, and by the way, I would say I get that same feeling. You know that like the day one of any production and you're just like, holy shit, is this, how is this going to go? I felt that way almost every Friday night.
Yeah.
Are people going to show up?
Yeah.
And so ultimately, I got a little bit of addicted to essentially putting that on, right? Putting on this production. But anyway, my foot in the door came from casting recruiting. And ultimately, it was like for dating shows and whatnot.
So you came up with a dating show background from the very beginning.
Yeah. Well, so here's where actually, you know, you were talking about when you talk about Howard Schultz.
Yeah.
So I grew up in a household that was already in the industry. Howard Schultz was my stepfather.
Okay.
So, and because he was my stepfather.
At what age did your mom?
Six. Howard? I was 6 years old.
Oh, okay.
So he was my formative years, for sure. But because he was in the business, I didn't want anything to do with it, to be honest with you. It was like, you know how you, sometimes you want to follow in the paths of someone that you idolize, and other times you kind of want to push away from it. And for me, it was like, And quite honestly, Howard would constantly say, you don't want to be in this business, you know? And ultimately, I got back to doing it because he was always really passionate about what is it that you're good at? Like, whatever it is you're good at, follow that, right? Don't worry about the money. Don't necessarily worry about what other people are going to think about it. Just follow your passion. And ultimately, what is it that you feel is a skill set that you have? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I got through college and here I am graduated and I'm like, what am I going to do? You know what I mean? And I honestly didn't know what I was drawn to. So I always fell back on that advice, which is like, what are you good at? And what I was good at was dealing with people, interacting with people. And so after futzing around for a couple of years after college, I worked on a cruise ship. And I mean, again,
those good stories there, by the way.
Wait, that's a great out of college job.
It was, I mean, so when it happened, he's like,
I've looked into that world. That's
we can't go down this road.
There's a lot
to save my partner. It could get really dicey.
There's a lot of dirty things that go on. And I'm not talking just hygiene. I'm talking.
Let's put it this way.
Death.
Cover-ups.
The
world. Look, I understand why Below Deck works. You know, at the end of the day, there is a whole world that is happening.
When you're in the water, the rules change.
Yeah. But anyway, so I went down that path, and ultimately, it came down to what is it that I'm good at, and that feeling of I can connect with people got me going down that path. Because Howard was in the industry, I had met other people. Person who gave me my first gig was Dawn Stroop. She was a casting director, had been around for a long time. And my first job was on Extreme Makeover, like a first real job. The casting recruiting stuff was like hit and miss. It was basically I was getting paid based on who I brought in. This was a weekly gig. And I got the foot in the door because of Howard's introduction.
You know, it's something we haven't talked about on the show much. We've talked about Extreme Makeover, Home Edition, obviously, because I had Mr. Foreman on the show. But I haven't talked about the original Extreme Makeover, which was one of the shows. Did Howard create that show?
He created that show. You know, for whatever reason, and this was like, he did the pilot and they loved it. But once they got into season one, essentially, there was production hiccups and whatnot. And ABC and Howard decided to part ways. Howard still owned the format, was still involved. But they brought in another production company to run that. That was actually worked for the production company that was not Howard.
You worked for them.
I worked for them. And ultimately ended up working for ABC. And I did 4 years of that. And that's really how I cut my teeth.
But for people that don't remember, that was a precursor, a kinder version of what The Swan was, wasn't it?
First off.
My memory of the original Extreme Makeover is a little hazy too.
The original Extreme Makeover really was ripped out of the idea that, you know, there are people who are just saddled with insecurities, things that they're unable to get over in their life. And it really came down to, you know, sometimes it was, sometimes it was a fit thing, but there's like, you know, look, some people just, they can't get past their physical makeup. Mm-hmm. And it ends up becoming this hindrance on the person that they are in the inside. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily, and if we were telling those stories, it wasn't necessarily that they weren't a beautiful person. They were a beautiful person, but they just didn't know it. Right. And so by going through this process, they would find themselves. And honestly, what it really came down to is people would do, it's like a 6-month process, really. So they would, you know, they'd be doing weight loss and they'd be working out and they would have plastic surgery. And again, some of these stories, especially some of the more movie ones for me, at least, so a lot of times it was more of a deformity opposed to vanity. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so that casting process was amazing.
So it's kind of a precursor to Botched, in a sense.
To a certain degree. I think
just not being exploited.
Put it this way. Think about Home Edition, right? Home Edition is you find a family that's in need, right? They have a story to tell. And then they get this amazing opportunity to get the house that they always dreamed of.
Right.
It's the same format.
Yeah.
But it's for people. Yeah. And I traveled around the country meeting people who were telling the story. There'd be people, you know, open casting calls, which no one does anymore. But, you know, it's like people lined up around the block to tell me their story and to be like, look at this. And it was like, it was crazy. But at the same time, it was a really great way for me to like sink my teeth into, like I was saying, what am I good at? And what I was good at was I could get people, right? I could hear their story. And to me, that was the goal every day, was trying to find that person who had that awesome story, that they were a beautiful person and they just didn't quite know it yet. And at the end of this process, they're gonna know. And that to me was like, I loved that. It was an awesome way to kind of like sink my teeth into story, into character, and why I ended up falling in love with the business.
When did you actually come over to Lighthearted?
So I did 4 seasons of Extreme Makeover, and then I bounced around. What I realized is after I kind of got sunk my teeth into the casting world and again leaned into what I knew, I ended up realizing I was only really like focusing on one spoke of the whole wheel. And I needed to become a producer. I wanted to sink my teeth into more of it. I ended up bouncing around Evolution for a while. Okay. I did a bunch of projects with them. I appreciate Doug giving me that opportunity. It was after a couple years of being there, Howard ended up having a conversation with Doug at the airport. They were like at MIP or something. And Doug had said, you know, Doug knew that I was, Howard was my stepfather. And he said something like, you know, Jeff's doing a great job, really. And I literally got a call from Mitt, and Howard was like, why are you working for my competitors? All of a sudden it kind of dawned on him.
But isn't it basically he needed that third party?
Yes.
Like he needed that third party validation.
Right. It was funny because it's like Howard and I never talked shop.
Yeah,
we just didn't have that relationship that way, because it was like he was always this thing like he didn't quite want me to do. Yeah. But all of a sudden he realized this. He's like, what? Wait a minute. Why aren't you working for me? And I think it was 2006. He's like, just come work in development with me for a while. See if you like it. And I jumped at the opportunity, to be honest with you. Not necessarily because I knew what I was getting myself into, but because I knew big things were going to happen. Howard was such a visionary. Like he was, and we could talk for days about Howard and his passion for the big idea.
Yeah.
And so
we'll get there.
Ultimately in 2006, I ended up at Lighthearted and started in the development. I mean, just started coming up with ideas, putting pen to paper. And honestly, that's where I really caught the bug about development. I mean, I've been, you know, been doing that ever since. And for me, that is who I am as a producer. I'm an idea guy. I'm a out of thin air guy.
Got it.
You know, I don't know that there are tons of people that are coming up with ideas out of nothing. I think a lot of people, it's like, you know, it's a character that you see or a link or whatever. And I really learned, and I learned from the best. I
mean, but that was Howard's MO, right? MO. It was original ideas, formats.
Yep.
You know, that weren't taken from international. It was homegrown ideas.
Yeah.
That were outside the box.
Yeah. And quite
your
honestly.
Your partner's getting itchy because.
I'm the one who normally occupies all of the words and the space in the room. This is fascinating to me.
I'm trying, like, because I'm meeting you guys for the first time, I'm trying to do like the mental gymnastics of like, who does what here? Like, I'm trying to figure out the partnership.
I think we're trying to figure that out too.
You guys have been many years together now running the company. Rob, before we get into when that moment happened, what was your background? Because the diligence I've done on you is that you were in physical production and on shows for quite a while. You were a part of the Apprentice team early on. But tell me, what was the first break?
So I slightly different from Jeff. I was the kid with the camera growing up. I was literally rolling VHS cameras around and hooking up two VCRs together to edit things from when I was young. I just was drawn to it all the way. And honestly, after I graduated from college, scripted, I tried it for a little while, but it moves so slowly.
So slow. And it's not a producer's medium.
It's not. And it's, to me, I wish that I was smart enough to know that then. All I knew was, this is so boring. And I was like,
where'd you go to school?
I went to Syracuse University.
Are you an East Coast guy?
No, actually, I grew up here. So strangely, that's right. Like everyone always asks, why the hell did you go there? I think I went there because I knew what I wanted to do and they had the great communication school. So I wanted to get out of LA because I knew I'd probably end up here. But anyway, so yeah, I graduated from Syracuse, great alumni network with Syracuse, and started getting jobs as a PA in LA. And then eventually I landed at Buna Murray Productions. And this was the late 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
So this was a time where there weren't a lot of reality shows. And, you know, so many people since that time have come out of there to an amazing success because Buna Murray was this awesome place where once you got in, you had a job, but it was like, here, grab a camera, try this. Try casting, try posts. I mean, it was people, everybody was young there. And John and Mary Ellis at the time really fostered this idea of like, we will figure out ways to keep you here if you are motivated and you're showing that you want to contribute. And I certainly did that. And so by the time I was there for about 3.5 years until like 2002, maybe 2001, I don't remember. But I had done everything. I'd done a ton of casting, which is one of the things that I was the most interested in. I'd worked post on multiple seasons of the show. I went to New Orleans, actually, ironically, where we are right now, and I was here to shoot The Real World New Orleans. And it was just every which way that you could go in that place, I went. And then, of course, in 2000, Survivor is a gigantic hit. Millions and millions of people are watching, and everybody in town suddenly now wants people who have experience with reality TV. And literally, Buna Murray became this clearinghouse of people who are rocketing to success very quickly because they had experience in making the shows. And I'm grateful to say that I was one of those people.
And what exactly, were you a Buna Murray employee or were you just a freelancer being bounced from show to show?
Permalance. Okay. I mean, that was just a way of being. And I think it's for a lot of people, it still is. Yeah.
How many years were you there?
About 3.5 years.
And describe, because it's funny, I did a live panel with Dan and Jane from Magical Elves here this week. And they launched their company in 2001. And I gave the audience context that, you know, Survivor premieres in 2000.
Right.
So in 2001, they started a company right at like the dawn.
Height. Yeah.
The boom. Yeah. The boom had really hit. So describe for me what it was like being in the office at Buna Murray just as the reality business is exploding. And they are one of the go-to production companies because of The Real World and Road Rules that had already launched previously.
It was incredible. I was 23, 24 years old. I don't remember exactly. And I'm going to meetings at NBC. And they're listening to me like how to cast these shows. And I'm getting involved in network programs on a high level at an extraordinarily young age. I mean, it was, and the funny thing about it is just like everything in life, you don't necessarily realize what's going on until later. You're like, holy shit. I was sitting there with Craig Plestis and this is just crazy. But it all made sense in the sense that we were the experienced ones. We had done it to success on Real World. And I had experience in all areas. I could speak to almost anything.
Yeah, because a lot of those reality executives early on, they hadn't come up through that medium.
No.
They were like people that had come over from like movies of the week,
yep.
or they've been from the comedy department,
talk shows,
yep. right? Late night yep. folks maybe took it over. So they did need the production people in those early days to explain to them how it worked, like you're saying.
Absolutely. And so then I did For Love or Money for NBC.
Oh, sure.
Plus hired me on that and introduced me to Three Ball and all those guys. I started casting on that show, and then I moved on and became a producer on the show and worked on the set with the talent and produced the main guy on the show. Like it was great. And that point, Three Ball, boom, that took off like a rock show. Oh, yeah. When I got to Three Ball, they had this one kids show, Endurance. It was small company with John, Todd, and JD. And that show,
I loved Endurance.
Yeah, that was a great show.
I had JD on the show.
Oh, yeah, I got to listen to that one.
I told him, I said, there was a show you did that I watched in college that I was probably too old to be watching. He's like, stop right there. I already know you're talking about Endurance. He's like, a lot of people tell me that all the time.
Yeah.
He's like, we had college kids watching Endurance every Saturday morning in their dorm rooms.
Yeah. So then after For Love or Money, I had established a relationship with Craig Plestis, and we got on great. And then he was like, I want you to meet Mark Burnett. And I'm like, fantastic.
Now, hold on. How old are you at this point?
I'm trying to put the numbers together in my head, but I was in my probably mid-20s.
Mid-20s, and the head of reality at NBC is like, hey, Rob, I want you to meet the king of reality television.
Yes. And it's a crazy story because then this was the point where Mark had sold the idea of The Apprentice to NBC, and they were at the stage now of trying to figure out, okay, so now what is the details of the show? What is this show going to be? And they were hiring some key development people, and yes. I came in from the casting angle. They wanted me to come in and sort of start to work with the development team that's creating the show. We had this office in Santa Monica that was, down the hall is Ted Smith and David Eilerberg. And we were like, they were doing their thing of coming up with the format and the challenges and how those would work. And we would talk and we would have meetings about, okay, here are the types of people that I'm finding, blah, blah, blah. And it was just really interesting because what do they need to be able to do? And of course, fast forwarding through the story, you know, I find Omarosa, Bill Rancic, all those people that are on the first season of the show. And then I go to New York to become a producer on the show. And we're all there figuring it out in what was one of the most amazing production. That first season of Apprentice was just absolute gold memories of all these amazing people who are tremendously successful now, all working on that show together, living in Manhattan.
Talk through that roster of all-stars that were working on that season one. You have Heather Schuster, David Eilenberg.
Absolutely.
Daryl Silver, who has his own production
absolutely.
Company. Who else was on there?
Let's see. Bill Pruitt.
Yep.
Jamie Kniff, who's at Sony. Now you're killing me. I'm the worst at this.
But it is
Jay Beanstalk.
Beanstalk. I mean, Beanstalk, of
amazing
course.
Showrunner. I mean, he was a huge part of why that show was so successful. But it's that thing where you're there. It was so much fun. Mark was there taking us out to dinner. Like it was fun. And I'm in my mid-20s living in Manhattan, making a TV show in Midtown. It's all paid for. I don't have to, it's just a fantasy.
Give me a President Trump anecdote.
I mean, so the way I describe him to people is that when you interact with him, when I would interact with him and watch anyone else interact with him, you have about 30 seconds when you're talking to him to make a point that, quite frankly, he agrees with. And if you do somehow make that point successfully in the first 30 seconds, he'll grant you maybe another 90 seconds. But other than Mark Burnett himself and maybe Jay Beanstalk, I've never seen anyone get past the 2 minutes. Like, that's it. You better cram in what you need to get to him in that 2 minutes, and hopefully he agrees with enough of it that you don't get just written off.
Is it because he doesn't like to give people the time, or is it because he doesn't have the attention span?
No attention span whatsoever. And, I mean, come on. We're talking about an immense, amazing, ridiculous ego like that you can't possibly imagine. Yeah. And I don't think I'm giving anyone a breaking news story there. It's like this guy he loves himself quite a bit. But, again, I said this to people, that show was the perfect crash course of two amazing things. Like, he had this giant ego. He wanted to show us his helicopter and his plane and his casinos and all his golden
regalia.
He's a perfect reality show.
Exactly.
You know, entity. I mean, he's the talent that you're always looking for.
And yeah, there's a lot of reality TV stars that you would not want to spend Thanksgiving with.
No, of course not. But they're great television.
We needed to show America why you should want to work for this person. And he wanted to show us why he was the greatest businessman in the world. And show America that he was the greatest businessman in the world, which, again, I have a twisted relationship with now. Because if you had asked me that then, if he would become president of the United States, I would have never in a million years, I would have laughed out loud. Because, again, but I never even thought about that. I was like, we have this person who wants to do exactly what we need him to do. And so half the time you're working on these shows and the talent
don't. Or how about the Omarosa would be working in the White House for the president as one of his chief advisors?
That's my feather in my cap right there. As far as reality TV casting, I challenge anyone to beat that.
We owe Omarosa to you.
Pretty much, yes. And she and I still have a relationship. And it's funny, she'll post on my Facebook and people trip out because they're like, this next post down. They're like, what the fuck?
She'll just like leave a comment.
Yes,
like, she'll comments. Like your picture.
She likes my pictures. Omarosa.
I gotta say, I got on the phone with her randomly for a project I was working on a few weeks back. And I didn't know what to expect. It was just going to be like a random call that we got set up. And she could not have been more lovely on the phone.
She is another person that gets it. She knows what she does.
Uh-huh.
She does.
Oh, of course.
But yeah, Bill Rancic was a big talent out of that, and he is an awesome guy. Still have a relationship with him. But it was just a fantastic experience. And I'm just kind of trying to fast forward because I want to get back to lighthearted.
Yeah.
So then I finished. I did a nonstop run on that show, literally that one show for about 3.5 years as well. Mm. It was literally like I would start the, because I headed up the casting of the show for many seasons. I would start the beginning of a casting thing, then go to shoot it in New York, then post it all the way through to delivery in post. And then right around that time, they were already picking up another season. So then I would just roll right into casting. So it was like, I funnily enough had a permalance job for 3.5 years on The Apprentice, did the first 6 seasons.
At Mark Burnett Productions.
At Mark Burnett.
And you were overseeing casting, but you said in post. So you would be involved in post.
Oh, I was not just the casting guy. I was also a producer on the show all the way through the experience. So I was in the field and in editing episodes.
Okay. Okay. So what was the next gig after that? What got you to Lighthearted?
Well, you said
before we started rolling, you talked about Tijuana.
Tijuana, yeah.
So you got him.
Was Troy Sear and John Foy. That was, I wanted to get out of Mark Burnett just because I wanted to, you know, I feel like every 3.5 years at that point in my life, I wanted to do something else. And at that point, John had and Troy had split out of Three Ball and they were starting their own company. I had made a sizzle reel for a show that I just wanted to pitch because I had the development bug. And so I literally came up with an idea, sold it to MTV. But I didn't have a company. But then I ended up finding, you know, 1,000 favors, went and shot in Louisiana, actually, ironically bringing it back here again, a little sizzle reel for a show.
Was that the first thing you ever sold on your own?
Absolutely. By myself to MTV.
Do you remember what it was?
I still want to sell this because it was basically like Reality Freaks and Geeks. It was called Band Geeks. And it was about a docu-series about a marching band
at
a high school. It's awesome. And I pray that somebody needs to call me after listening to this podcast and say, we want to make that show. Because
Rob, after Cheer?
Absolutely.
After seeing Cheer on Netflix?
I should call Brandon.
You should call that director.
Yes, and get him to do this. Because it's so good. And it had a heart and everything. But then I needed a company, you know, to do something. And I really, that sizzle became my calling card. And I kind of took it around like, hey. And as soon as John and Troy saw it, they're like, why don't you leave Mark and become our VP of development? And that was my first development gig, working for them for several years. Then we ended up creating a lot of fun shows. I created a show called Obsessed that was on A&E about people with severe obsessive compulsive disorder, very gritty docu-series, which I'm still very proud of. It's fun to use this medium to actually literally help people, which we did. And then I did another show called Is She Really Going Out With Him, which was, I think, my first dating show. And that was great because it was kind of a comedy mixed with a dating show. And it was so much fun to make. We did 60 something episodes of that, three seasons.
For what network?
That was for MTV. So that was my first MTV dating show right there.
So that developed the relationship with MTV.
Absolutely. Yeah. Even with Real World, I had relationships with people going back there. Eventually, I left Tijuana, became an independent showrunner for a while. And that's when we finally get back to Lighthearted Entertainment. And that's when I was with CAA. They were representing me. And they said, you want to have a meeting with Howard Schultz. Now, at this point in my life, I was still under the probably somewhat mistaken impression that I could start a company. I really wanted to start my own company. I was coming up with pitches. I was trying to start a company essentially on the back of an idea that I sold, which was just so, it's almost impossible now, but it was even hard then. And I was starting to lose steam with people giving me favors because I didn't have any money to pay them to shoot these sizzle reels. Like, I was using every relationship I had had trying to sell something. And at first I didn't want to meet with Howard because I was like still having this dream. And then finally CA convinced me to go. I go to Lighthunter Entertainment. It was like a four, this is so Howard. This is a, like a 4:30 p.m. meeting. I sit down alone with him in his office.
Where was the office?
Burbank.
Still in Burbank?
Yeah, yep. We're still in Burbank. We're in the building right nearby, but yeah, not the exact same. But I sat down, Howard closes the door. We start talking and I like to talk. But Howard, he loves to talk. He loved to talk. But two people who love to talk in the room together. Literally, I remember when the meeting finally ended, three hours later, I opened the door to the bigger office outside and everybody was gone. Literally, we had just talked and talked and talked and talked. And we got along so well. And he was just a special person.
Let's get into this, because this is something that, you know, we're coming up, as I was doing my research, we're coming up, or we just had the five-year anniversary from when he passed away. And Howard Schultz, he founded Lighthearted in 1992. He developed, as a young executive, he developed Real People for NBC in 1979, which was like, it's looked as like one of the first reality shows.
Yep.
That's Incredible came after that,
yep,
after the success of Real People. In 91, he did Studs.
Yep.
Studs was the best.
When he was working over Fox, I have fond childhood memories of watching Studs.
Howard, in a weird way, taught me a lot about sex and relationships. He just didn't know it.
But like from the very beginning, I mean, like setting the tone with like even Studs in 91 before he formed his company, like it was always like outside the box, splashy, headline grabbing formats.
He, in my opinion, and I'm so glad you're saying this and I didn't have to, is not given enough credit for what he has done and did do in this industry sometimes. Yeah. I think there's a lot of big names that certainly deserve credit as well, but I think his name is too often left out.
Yeah.
And the other reason that it should be talked about is how special, as I said, of a person he was. And the best way I can describe it to you is that he loved TV. He loved ideas. He literally used to say, I don't want to just hit a home run. I want to hit the cover off the ball. That's how big of a home run. I want it to be insane. So he loved that. But even more than that, he loved people. And that's the talking thing. I was so amazed at how much he cared about me as a person in that first 3-hour talk. Like how much he was interested in what was going on in my life, much more than how I knew how to produce a reality show. And I just never seen that before. I'd never encountered that in a business environment where somebody was just so obviously different. And it went from me being like, I don't know if I really want to do this. I want to still try to open my company too. I got to be here. This is the right place for me to be.
And you came in at what title?
I came in, what was my title coming in?
You mean SVP?
SVP.
SVP.
And the thing about it too was, you know, Howard wanted at that point in his career to downshift, as he used to say all the time. He's like, I don't want to pull the sled anymore. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to bring somebody in who was all charged up to pull the sled. And that was obviously me.
But you are still charged.
Oh, I'm always charged up.
Always. Actually, and hold on.
But you guys
have the other part is the Jeff part is the other key.
Well, but there's another side of this, like, because that's his POV. But I think it's important to know where we were as a company.
Yes.
Up at that moment.
When Rob joined?
Yeah, when Rob joined. We had, our whole business was a format business. It was ownership. We had, you know, we had huge success with the Moment of Truth. I traveled all around the world setting that we were in like over 60 countries and setting that up. And literally we had a consulting business where we would go and help these, I mean, very small productions launch the show, doing things that they had never done before in television. It was an awesome experience. But we had that tremendous success, right? But as we all know, the industry started to change. And making those deals and having that big knock the ball out of the park and the cover off of it, that was harder and harder to do. And I remember specifically about 2 or 3 weeks prior to Rob walking through the doors, a conversation with Howard. I honestly was a little bit drained. And Howard and I had a good heart to heart. And Howard was tired. He was kind of like beaten down a little bit by the process. And I was honestly thinking about moving on.
What year is this?
Oh, gosh.
I'm so bad with years. Everyone else knows years. I never know. It must have been about 10 years ago.
How long? 9 years ago. Nine or ten. Yeah.
But, okay. Yeah. I mean, how long was this before Howard passed?
Years before.
This is
3-4 years you were there?
But we had this conversation. It was bottom line. It was Howard was, I don't know if I want to keep doing what we're doing. I was very honest with him about saying, you know, maybe it's time for me to move on as well, which is obviously was a sticky conversation to have because not only is this my boss and someone that I've been with for at this point years, but he's also my stepfather. And, but at the end of it was probably a very similar long conversation. It was, I'll give it a go again. If you want to stick around and give it a go, but let's bring someone in to help energize this process. And so that was, and it doesn't surprise me to hear that Howard that you guys had such a great conversation because that was Howard. Once he put his mind to something, it was like, okay, now I'm all in. It went from like, I don't know if I want to keep doing this to, okay, now I'm all in. Let's freaking win the game.
He did everything full speed.
Yes, 100%. And he, with intention, I think the word he would use is intention. And the moment he had intention to be successful and to kind of let's re-energize this place, it's not surprising. It's serendipitous that we found someone, my loquacious partner here, who honestly did energize the company, energized me. And you know, I'm blessed to have him as a partner. And ultimately, the company is better for it. And
I mean, the projects that the company was known for, I mean, Dating Naked, we talked about Extreme Makeover, The Moment of Truth, which was a big cultural moment when that show did come out.
Moment of Truth, amazing.
And by the way, Next.
Yeah.
Like Next. I freaking loved Next. Yeah. I think I may even like auditioned for Next, like right out of college, like to be on a dating show or something. Like Next was fantastic. And he was there for Are You the One, when that sold and got through.
Yeah.
But talk me through as a boss, as a man who set the culture of the company, like explain to me what he may have passed on that you guys have tried to carry forward in terms of a corporate culture and how you treat employees and running the team.
We have this thing that we call the lighthearted way. And like we hashtag it a lot and we shoot things on the set and put it up on social media. And then our crew who we work with somewhat consistently, we have that great band of cowboys that we roll through different shows with that all work for us consistently. They've started to do that. And there's a meaning behind it. It's not just like the name of our company. And it's about the way we approach producing. And Jeff and I both came up through the ranks. We both were PAs and had every single job all the way to now company owners. And we get what it's like to be on these shows. We get how brutal it can be to produce a reality show and what people give of themselves for a show and sometimes not even get paid that well to do it because they have passion. You know, like I was listening to one of the other podcasts talking about being the redheaded stepchild. I think it's so offensive to me to be the redheaded stepchild considering how hard all these people work. I mean, just because we don't make scripted shows, I think that's a completely ridiculous notion that anyone should be disrespected. And it all goes back to Howard. And I think Howard cared about the people working for him. He cared about the crews. He wanted people to have a positive experience, a life experience. It wasn't just about the TV show. And we try our best kind of with that hashtag as the beacon to do the same thing. It's like we want people to want to work for us and enjoy the experience of working for us. And I think thankfully that culture is changing because I think for a while there, especially when he and I were young, people were getting pretty whipped around on reality shows. And I think, the funny thing is it doesn't take that much more money to do it the right way.
So December 2014, he makes you guys co-owners in the company.
Yep.
He makes you officially partners.
Yeah.
And that's when the ink dried on that. And that's another thing I want to say about Howard. It's like a year prior to him dying, he comes to Jeff and I, who at this point, Howard had moved to Colorado. His dream was this ranch that he has in Boulder. And at that point, Jeff and I, because again, when I joined, there was pretty much no shows. And this relationship between me and Jeff was now everything because now I brought some energy back to the company. Jeff was this amazing resource that I didn't even realize how great it was until I started working there. I'm like, this is not just a partner. This guy's like my brother. like the brother I never had.
Did you guys hit it off right away?
Yeah. Insanely quickly.
Because you guys were like an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were. And
it could have gone horrible.
And Howard knew that, by the way, because Howard didn't.
He actually sent us on a date.
No.
Yeah, before Howard made me an offer.
He wasn't going to get an offer.
I was curious. I was curious how much he involved you, Jeff.
I was the next meeting with Rob.
Yeah. And I knew the importance of that meeting.
Wait, hold on. What was the date? What was it?
We went to coffee.
Yeah, we did.
We went to coffee at Starbucks.
Starbucks. Of course. We're all business partnerships come together.
Special place.
Yeah, I knew that that was going to be, not only did I knew I needed his approval, but I knew that I wanted to, like, this, if we're going to do this, I can't do this alone. I needed him. And so I was like, who is this guy? Like, I didn't know him at all. And, you know, we just sat down, started talking, and then literally haven't stopped. At least me.
Hey, Jeff, were you a director or VP when this happened?
I think I was a VP at that point.
You were already a VP at that point. Okay. And then Rob's going to come in as SVP.
SVP.
Yep. And you guys are going to tag team things. Correct. And that goes on for a matter of years. You guys start growing the slate.
And we started selling shows. The first show we sold really was 72 Hours to TNT, which was right after your Heroes show.
I remember that. We were at the same event in New York.
Yeah.
It was like, I think when I had King of the Nerds.
The upfronts.
Upfronts. Yeah. I think when I had King of the Nerds out there, you guys had By the way, I
want to tell you, as format guys, we loved that show. And I know you came up with that show. And congrats
honestly,
to you.
Craig and Rick are great guys. And we used to come up to them all the time and be like, that is such a genius show.
It is. I mean, it was a team. It was. I lit the fire. I lit the fuse. I poked. And
that's fine.
But it was a team that came up with the format. But I'm very proud of that.
You should be.
It's the most. It's right up there with the most fun I've ever had on set.
You could tell. Yeah, I mean, it was a great show.
Oh, you could tell in the edit how much the editors enjoyed that show, because we did the green screen, but we would do all these, like, you know, we were trying to make a commentary on the traditional reality competition format, you know, within the show. Totally. And we knew, because it was always meant to be a comedy competition show, that we could get away with certain things. Thanks for saying that.
No,
but
awesome.
I remember like 72 Hours being at the same upfront, because it was like one of my first upfronts that I'd ever been.
Golden age of TNT. This is when Michael Wright was buying everything.
Totally.
We had The Rock on. It was awesome.
I remember telling when we sold The Hero to Michael Wright at TNT, I remember telling Dwayne Johnson before the meeting, okay, I'm just gonna say, when we get into the room to close the meeting, I want you to look Michael Wright in the face and say, Michael, and you and I, we're going to be on stage together at the upfronts, selling the show to the press, selling the show to the advertisers. I want you to say that to him at the end of the meeting. And he did. And he's like, Michael, me and you, we're going to be on stage right next to each other. And I'm going to be at all the events, and I'm going to push this with you. And Michael Wright's eyes just lit up. Because at this point, even way back then, I mean, this is like, I don't know, 8 years ago. It was a long time ago. The Rock was already the biggest box office star in the world, you know. Michael Wright, by the way, how great was Michael Wright?
He's fantastic.
Is he one of the best executives you've ever worked with?
He was fantastic.
At a high level?
By the way, that was actually one of our first real pitch meetings. About a month after you came on board? Because we had already teed it up with Rachel.
Yep.
Rachel Brill. And so and we had done a bunch of work on this show. It was a huge, gigantic show with like $2 million helicopter line.
Huge.
Right? And ultimately,
they were spelling broadcast money.
We walked in that meeting with Michael Wright, and at the end of that meeting, Michael says, let's do it. That was one of those, yes, we sold it in the room.
Era gone.
Right. Okay. I'm not alone in feeling that.
No,
right?
No.
Because we're not sitting across from the decision makers. Yeah. You know, you're sitting across from somebody who's going to
decision makers.
Yeah. There's marketing and programming. Yep.
So few even decision makers have the loan.
100%. Exactly.
100%.
I think is the thing. Yep. It's not really one person's job to say yes anymore.
Nope.
So December 2014, you guys, the ink dries. It's official. You guys are co-owners in the company.
Yeah. Well, let me tell a story, because this was a key moment where, like, I had been there for a while. Howard wanted to move to the ranch and was essentially like really stepping out the door. And that's when he came.
Was that the understanding that he was going to?
He was like, I'll be available anytime you need me. Just call me.
But was he going to be based in Boulder?
Absolutely. Yes. Live there.
Okay. So
he sold his house. He'd moved to Colorado, was living his dream, which, by the way, feels great, because he got to do that. It happened.
He did. Okay.
But before he left, this is about a year before he died, he came to the two of us, and this is another special thing about Howard, and offered us to be cut in to the ownership of the company. Mm. How many owners of companies in this town do you know that would do that? Even if they were moving to Colorado, they wouldn't. They wouldn't give up the equity. That was his mentality. He's like, I see your passion. I see what you have done here on his shoulders for sure. He's like, I'm going to stay a part of it. I still want to keep part of the equity, but I'm going to give it to you guys. I'm going to let you guys write your story.
You know, you're so right. Because as I was doing my research, I was like, wait a second. So he had an EVP and a VP. I didn't know the family connection, yeah. Jeff. But I was like EVP and VP, and he gave them ownership.
Crazy.
Not long before he passed away out of the blue. I was like, how many bosses ever do that? If their hand is not forced in some way, but also here's what most people would have done. Most people, and we've seen this history, mm-hmm. most people would have just sold their company.
Yep.
Yep.
And then retroactively given their lieutenants a taste, mm-hmm. whatever they deemed enough. But if someone's going to move to Boulder or move away from the business and take the foot off the gas, most people would have just sold.
Yeah.
Yep. They would have just sold and left people there under contract, yep. to run the company.
He could have. Yep.
And he could have done that. Why do you think he didn't consider selling?
Because he's Howard Schultz. That was the right thing to do. Yeah. He knew that he and I together had rebuilt the company, taken it in brand new directions. Mm-hmm. We had opened up cable, which had not really, yeah. been a big part of their business. We were
also
the ship was taking off
too.
Yeah,
production services. Didn't, like I was saying earlier, it's like the formats and the ownership of those formats was the model. That, mm-hmm. was the business model.
It wasn't the physical production.
No, it was like hit a home run and let the checks come in,
right?
Because of overseas. And yeah. ultimately that just was drying up. And so,
right.
as we took the helm, we said, it's time to start getting bays. We got to get more space. Yeah. Let's start growing this infrastructure.
And we were selling shows, so we were able to pay for it. And we now have 20 edit bays, color mix, full production suite, everything.
Well, it shows. I mean, in your guys' minds, do you think he ever would have sold, like, years later, if you guys had reached critical mass and obviously Are You the One turns out to be what it is? Do you think he ever would have sold? Do you think he just never was interested?
I think he was interested in that, but I think he was more interested in taking care of these,
yes.
two guys that he,
yes.
deeply cared for. That was, like, going back to what I said before. He, yeah. cared about us as people.
And he
first.
Clearly had faith in you guys, yes. that under your administration, with him taking his foot off the gas, the company was only going to grow.
Yes.
Yep.
So why would he sell?
Correct.
Because it's about to boom with you two at the helm.
I think that's probably he would say the same thing.
He had full faith in you, yeah. guys.
So
happens, and it's a year later.
Well, we made the deal then. It was like the ink dried in December.
That's what I'm saying.
And then,
yeah.
yes, a few weeks later. And I
he say weeks this later.
All the time. It's almost like he knew. Because if you think about it, if he had passed away and this plan was not set in place, it could have been a brutal situation, because then people can get weird in those moments. Who knows if what would have happened? But it just everything, all the plan was completely laid out as to how that would all be handled, because we had an mergers and acquisitions lawyer draw everything up, and it was all done. So while it was emotionally brutal to go through his passing, and I mean, I don't even want to speak to Jeff, it's another level altogether. Yeah. It was also amazing, because I kept sitting there in my grief saying, he knew somehow this was going to happen, and he wanted to even take care of us in that sense. Like, even in our grief, he was still taking care of us.
Had his health been in question? Because it was just so people know, it was an
total
unforeseen
sudden
heart attack,
yep.
in Hawaii,
yep.
with the family.
Yep. But there? It wasn't a heart attack. It was a stroke. But yeah.
A stroke.
Yeah. Were you I was there. Yeah. Yeah. On the beach. Yeah. It was tough. It was tough. It was one of those things where you never expect it. You don't.
Yeah. Do you also agree with him that he knew?
I don't know if I go. You know what I would attribute it to is Howard was, like I said, he had intention. So every single decision he made and every single day that was in front of him, he tried to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and that's like, how many of us don't, you know, go through any given day with a regret of what we might have done, and, oh, I wish I would have spent a little bit longer paying attention to my kid, or having that conversation, or telling my wife I love her, or whatever it might be. And for him, I think he was just so solely focused on doing the right thing and having integrity in those moments that it allowed for it to look like he knew. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, where it's like, by him just saying, this is the right thing to do, his life was buttoned up the way it needed to be buttoned up. And I will tell you, after we signed that deal, and that was, you know, it was like a week or so between that and then, was like, he was the happiest I'd seen him in a while. Like, I don't mean like happy, boisterous happy. I mean like heartfelt peace.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it was because he It was like this. I've done what I wanted to do. I feel good about this moving forward. I get to live with my wife in this beautiful ranch in Colorado. I got these two guys running a company that I love that I've built with my two hands, and I know that they're going to continue to grow.
It's like watching your kid graduate.
Yep.
Totally. You know, it's like watching a kid graduate. You've raised them, you've nurtured, and you trust that they're going to now move on and do the right thing, and they're ready.
Yeah.
And that's clearly what he felt, like you saying he had that release.
Yeah.
How old was he?
He was 56, I think.
56.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. I didn't know the whole story. And I know there's a lot of people out there that don't know the whole story. Yeah. And I wanted to honor the man. I couldn't believe it was like just past the 5-year anniversary as we were setting up to do this.
Jeff and I had bought him as a gift, Christmas gift. Was it Christmas?
Yes. Yeah, it was that.
This buffalo head. Because he went
for the home?
For the ranch. Yeah, for the ranch. And it was because he was a Colorado Buffaloes fan. And
did he grow up in Colorado?
Yeah.
No, he grew up in Illinois, but he went to University of Colorado.
Oh, yes. He did? Okay, so he still had a lot of a connection to the university?
Yes, he did.
Absolutely. Okay. And so after he passed, we called Tana, his wife, and asked for it back because it now hangs on the wall of Lighthearted Entertainment, like right in the center where everyone gathers together.
Do you have a name for
Howard.
It?
Howard.
Oh, you named it Howard? All right, so you guys have to now make the transition to running a company,
mm-hmm.
right? To being company heads now. And the training wheels are off. How many employees are there at the time when you guys now are full-fledged leaders?
Teens,
of the company?
Probably somewhere in the teens.
You guys are full staff.
Yeah.
And the show, Are You the One, had already sold.
Yes.
Had it aired?
Yes.
It had season one had aired?
Yes. Yeah. And that was an amazing success to have. Like it was... Yes. It was one of those things that kind of took off, and
tell me about how it sold. Tell me about what the development process was for this.
That was a classic Lighthearted internally developed idea. It was a development team effort that we were kicking around dating shows and stumbled upon. Really, the key of the entire show was this idea of playing the game of figuring out who your perfect match was. This idea that standing across from you could be what science. What matchmaking, what the universe is saying should be your perfect match, could you figure it out amongst a group of people? And that simple game concept was really the light bulb moment where we're like, oh, that's an interesting idea, because everyone fundamentally wonders if they have a perfect match and whether the person that they're with is that person. What if we made this show that sort of tested that idea?
I always like asking how many of the format points that were in the finished episodes that's for season four part of the pitch.
A lot.
All of them.
Yeah, right? Yeah. All the major beats.
What happens so many times.
It's a genius format. I mean, I know you don't need me to tell you that because it's been so extremely successful. But guys, it's one of the most creative like formats I've come across.
Thank you so much. And I want to say something to all networking executives that listen to this. If I pitched you that format right now, you'd think I'm crazy. Like, so there's going to be in Hawaii, there's going to be this hut that looks like Gilligan's Island, and inside of it, it's going to be a spaceship, and we're going to call it the Truth Booth, and it's going to laser scan them and tell them whether they're a perfect match or not. I mean, it sounds completely nuts.
Laser scan was just a great,
yeah.
By the way,
just a great choice because it serves no purpose. But it's just a great creative.
You
choice.
Have to trust. Our point is that you have to trust it. You have to go all in and buy into it.
But speaking of network notes, did you get the note in the room? Well, what if they all match up? Like,
that was like a big question.
By episode two.
Oh, that, by the way, that was part of our pitch. We spun that, which is every show's a finale then.
Right.
Right? Any moment, any time.
But is that the understanding with the network? It was like, if that happens, then you ordered six episodes, not
right?
eight.
There was an understanding there, but we also had, you know, literally had a professor of statistics analyze the game, and that's how we decided how many contestants we needed on the show, because he did computer modeling of thousands and thousands of different iterations and basically told us that most likely we were going to get to, I think he said, eight episodes.
When did you do that?
That was early on, yeah.
Wait, during the development process?
Yes.
You did that?
We fully develop ideas. Like, we're not the guys that come in with like just the log line. We're like the guys that come in with the whole show.
But Rob, that is the greatest answer to a network note I've ever heard, is that you literally got like a world-class mathematician, statistician guy to tell you the odds that note that you're given is ever going to happen.
Well, that was an anticipation.
But like, if I'm a network executive and I give you that note, because that seems like the one note you could give on this format, because it's a genius format, That's the greatest response. I guess, no, we've already had a professional statistician tell us the odds of that happening are very, very unlikely.
Yep.
So just trust us.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of trust us going on.
Who was the network executive that believed in the show from the beginning?
Well, Tiffany Williams was the first person that we pitched it to, and she certainly believed
in it. At Real Screen, by the way. Yeah. So don't let anyone tell you you can't sell something at Real Screen.
Amazing. Yes. So that kind of teed up the second meeting back in LA.
And then the other person that I want to give a big amount of credit to is Suzanne Daniels, who at that point was 1 month into her reign at MTV.
Yeah.
And she truly brought in a brand new energy to MTV that we hadn't seen. And the funny thing about the pitch to Tiffany was they were in Teen Mom land heavy at that point. And it was like, it's huge success. It's great. And so we would have never even thought to pitch a format to them at that time. And we were at Real Screen. We ran into Tiffany, started talking to her. And we just thought it was going to be a general, like, get to know her, because we didn't know her. And then she's like looking at Jeff's iPad and is like, what's on there?
No, like we are like, literally, we don't have anything to pitch you. Sorry. Like said, and she's like, let me see what you have.
Like we said, no, we don't want to pitch you. We just want to get to know you. And she's like, give me that thing.
Wow.
And then she looks at all the icons, scrolls through.
Like, what's that?
What's that? What's that? What's that? And then boom.
It was called Perfect 10 at that time.
Yeah. And then so she then brought it back, as they all do after Real Screen, showed it to Suzanne, and Suzanne, I mean, we've heard from multiple different people, absolutely loved it.
But that's like, that alone is kind of unheard of.
Totally.
That a paper development, original idea.
It was a sizzle reel.
Oh, you had a sizzle.
Yeah.
Okay, you had the sizzle.
Oh, yeah, and it was a great sizzle. Yeah. But like you said, the show was all there, and everything, the truth booth, the matchups, all that stuff was in the pitch.
What was the first step?
The casting step. We run into that quite a lot.
Casting and bio.
Casting and development.
Yeah. Jeff and I both really cut our teeth in casting. That's what our passion lies, and we truly believe it's the whole show. Like, as good of a format as Are You the One might be, as you say, it all depends on the cast. If you have a great cast season one, you have the ability to go. So if that exact same format had a crap cast, it might have died right then and there.
Well, let's talk about that, because season eight, the first LGBTQ filled cast, people that are gender fluid.
Yep. Sexually fluid.
Sexually fluid, sorry. Did you guys have any understanding of the impact that choice would make to that community?
Look, I want to say yes, but I also realize, and this is why I think it did find that audience and was received as it was, is that I knew enough that I didn't know. Mm. You know, I realized very early on, and Rob did too, is that as we were going through that casting process, that their experience is not my experience.
Yeah.
And we vowed to each other, but also kind of made sure that everyone that worked on the project got that this isn't about putting these kids in a fishbowl and us seeing it through our lens. Mm-hmm. Let's tell their stories.
Yeah.
And ultimately, we'll if we follow them, and we give them the opportunity to just be who they are, then it will end up being the same show that it's always been. This is season eight, and these are these kids. But it's still about finding love, and it's still about them figuring out themselves. And so by us not saying, hey, everybody, look, these kids are gender fluid.
Yeah.
I think that's why it resonated, because it wasn't about that. It was just about these people trying to find love, and they just happened to be sexually fluid.
My assistant, who's a proud member of that community, I was talking to her and the rest of my team before I left, because I did this podcast earlier where I gave out like my fake awards for like 2019, and I wanted to give out my 2019 Rookie of the Year award for a show that burst on the scene. And she was like, oh, the most recent season of Are You the One? I mean, the LGBTQ season, like, for sure. And I'm like, well, doesn't count because it's season eight. But like, that was her. I was like, tell me a show. Like, what am I? I had a list. I'm like, what am I forgetting? Like, there's a lot of shows that made a lot of buzz that were like, they had fans obsessed in 2019. And that was the first thing out of her mouth, is how much that show meant to that community. And congratulations, guys.
We're proud of it.
But I can't let you guys leave. We're going to wrap up soon. But I cannot let you leave. And I cannot let you off the hook without mentioning Labor Games.
Listen.
Okay, hold on.
We talked about that with TLC yesterday. I want that shit brought back.
Okay, before I get it, I got to tell you why. I got to tell you why. Because it was in DC like a few years ago. I am my friends that I'm my closest to, I went to college with, they don't work in the industry, right? And they think what I do is just nonsense. They think I work in reality TV and they make fun of me. And they think everything I do is a joke. And I tell them I go to these conferences like once a year. And they're like, oh, yeah, so people are like pitching like blah, 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 blah. So they gave me a lot of shit that year. And I come in and I'm at Real Screen and I walk by a conference room. And I'm on my way to like a meeting I got to get to. But the doors open and there's a ton of people in this conference room. So I just kind of poke my head in and people are like laughing and making noise. I'm like, what? I poke my head in and on like the big screen in this conference room is a trailer for Labor Games. And I walk into that room and I'm not insulting you because we all,
no, please, no. Please.
But I walk into that room and I was like, if my friends saw this right now,
exactly,
they would be like, this confirms everything we've been saying about that reality TV conference you go to every year. But the producer in me was like, oh, that's fucking good. Like the producer in me was like, whoever created this is a freaking genius.
You're looking at him.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
I'm still so proud of that show. And I think it's insane that it's not on TV for 100 episodes.
Wait, give the log line.
A woman and their partner together. I've had 3 children. I've been in the labor and delivery room. I haven't experienced it personally, but I've been a part of it.
Yep.
It's a funny place. It's a tremendous moment in your life, emotional, high stakes at the absolute highest. Well, what we decided to do was surprise women in labor at the hospital with a game show where they would win essentially prizes in the form of things for their baby and ultimately money for their baby's college fund. So while they're in the midst of contractions in between, we throw trivia questions their way and almost a cash cabby kind of fun, spirited game that is for the baby.
What hospital did you get the clearance to do this?
It was not Eastern LA. I forget. Yeah. Pomona? Pomona. Yeah, Pomona.
You did this in California?
Yeah, absolutely.
So you were they on camera before giving their... We approval?
We kind of sprung it on them, and then they would sign, and then we would
and then you'd start recording.
Exactly,
got it.
But we had an entire actual delivery room in the hospital that was ours,
that was
and
wired.
We rigged it with all these LED strips.
Yes, because there was like lights flashing.
So when they're in there, it doesn't look like it looks like any other delivery room. And then all of a sudden, the host would go in and be like, I know you're having these contractions, but do you want to play Labor Games? And then they'd be like, okay, fine.
Rob,
all of a sudden, the LED lights will go on. The sign falls from the ceiling. You're on Labor Games.
Rob, I mean, if I had been the network executive hearing that pitch, I would have bought it in the room. Because I vividly remember during the birth of our first child, in between pushes.
There's actually some time.
We were watching HGTV. Yeah. We were literally watching HGTV. And like, it was because it calmed my wife. Like HGTV is just like what really like calms her down. And it's comfort television. And in between pushes, like even the doctor who's like standing there, like in front of my wife, like ready to go, would turn around, you know, and like we'd all be looking in the corner of the room at HGTV. And I'd be like, oh, that's like an interesting tile choice that you chose for the mask. Yeah. We're up again. Okay, start pushing. And so I totally get how that completely could work.
It's the funny thing that
you'd only go one season.
One season, it's something a bunch of guys would say, like, yeah, you know, it's kind of easy. You know, you get a lot of hot time on your hands when you're in the labor.
Right.
No, we did once. I mean, look, everyone who's listening to this podcast, when you see Howard Lee next, tell him bring back Labor Games. That's the gift that people can give to me and Jeff. They did this thing called Mother of All Weeks, which was this giant week of specials. And we made, I think,
Mother's Day.
Yeah, for Mother's Day. We did make 8 of them, but they just took one and aired it in that week of Mother of All Week specials. It popped a number that week, but the problem was the rest of the episodes weren't on the schedule. They just were holding on to them. And when that one episode aired, the next day we were a joke on David Letterman. We were on Good Morning America, the Today Show. It was a front page article in the New York Times about the show. Again, it was the usual, you know, this is the end of the world and Rob LaPlante is Satan stuff. But it was like we were everywhere. And then there was nowhere for people to go to find it because it had aired once. And then the Duggars happened, that summer of where the Duggars controversy bubbled to the surface. And then TLC kind of pressed the reset button a lot. And we just got lost. And I'm telling you
show. Did the other episodes never air?
Oh, they did.
They ran them off.
Yeah. They ran them off.
It was not the right time for them to be doing a show like that. That was really loud and sort of a little controversial.
By the way, that's where we live. I mean, if you think about if you think about like some like dating naked, like we're always on the edge where people go like, that's super dangerous. And it sounds a little like crazy. But the thing that I think if someone like gets their foot in the door with them, people, like, if you watch Dating Naked and you forget the part that they're naked, you also you realize, like, wow, there's a good story here. Like,
yeah,
these are like, there's love happening here.
That's just to get the audience in.
Totally.
And then the story would take you through. Games,
absolutely. Right? It's like, it's loud. And then all of a sudden you watch it and you go, this is sweet.
And they were winning, winning money for their baby's college fund. And it was like these cute questions. And we had the great moment where there would be a contraction that you'd be like, oh. And
did you have after the baby was there and them holding the child for the first time? Yeah. So like, were there to bitch about?
It's like the best version of a baby story you ever saw, because it's fun.
The miracle of life at the end, and a couple holding their child.
Yeah, and Howard Lee. Call Howard Lee. By the way, Dating Naked, also, before we finish, one of the greatest pitch stories. We pitched that to Kristen Kelly and Susan Levinson with, because it's funny, because we were talking about this earlier, like when you pitch a format, you're pitching, of course, initially the concept. So we pitched the idea of that in today's world, one of the things that people are complaining about dating-wise is that we're supposed to be more connected in the apps and all stuff, but people actually think it's causing us to be less connected.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're like, how could we create a dating environment that was the most honest, non-catfished, non-dating app environment possible? How could we put people in the most vulnerable, truthful, honest position possible? Take everything away, including their clothes, and have them stand in front of each other and meet that way. Wonderful, fun idea, but we had to explain the format of the show.
It's like always, we're, you know, can be death in a room.
Yes, it's like now we got to talk about the math of it all, you know, and that's where you could they love the concept, and then you could lose them. And one of the things we've talked about a long time is like sometimes the numbers get people confused. Mm-hmm. We're like, how can we physically represent the numbers? So then we came up with the best idea ever. We pitched the format of Dating Naked with a bunch of naked Barbies and naked Kens.
Genius.
Like, it was creepy because we had a development, these go to the store and buy a
take
bunch
off
of
all
Barbies.
Their clothes.
I need you to take off all their clothes. And then we stuffed them in a bag and brought them to pitch. And we're like, okay, so there's going to be a girl and a guy and then a naked. And Kristen Kelly laughed her ass off. And Susan Levinson loves anything that punches people in the face. She loved it. And that was just Dating Naked took off like a rocket.
Did it sell around the world?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It did.
Yeah.
Did Labor Games sell around the world?
Yes.
Yeah, it did. There was some, in both cases, tape. No one was willing to do their own.
Okay, they didn't do local versions.
No.
Guys, like, this was a treat.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Look at that.
Okay, that was harmless. Look, Rob didn't say anything that's going to get us in trouble.
So far, our company is still intact.
Yeah.
I think you guys are good. Okay. Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it.